session number 30304.
Serena, reel 19.
Ted, what form did the anti-submarine patrols take? I'm thinking, would it be part of a convoy escort, or would there be an area that you would take of the sea, or would it be both?
Well, in my experience from WIC, we were more often than not sent out as convoy escorts. And we would patrol... having found the convoy, which didn't always happen, and I used to think, incidentally, that it was our fault if we didn't meet the convoy. But then I've known since then that it wasn't just our fault, that the convoys weren't sometimes where they were supposed to be. They thought they were in this position, but in fact they weren't, and that was the position we were given. So perhaps that released me from a little guilt there. But we would patrol again with a certain amount of freedom. I mean, it depended on the day. What needed to be done. We would obviously, when we approached a convoy, find where the SNO was, senior naval officer, and exchange greetings with him. They had some unusual greetings in the Navy. We responded in kind, of course. It's always quite friendly, but sometimes very funny. There came a time when we had to identify ourselves, when we had exchanged greetings, sometimes we would be asked to investigate. We've lost a trailer somewhere. He may be 20 or 30 miles back. Go and find him, please. There's something suspicious. Is there something following us, or somebody over on possibility of some danger over on the port side there? We were there to help in whatever way we could, within the basic plan of being able to go all round the convoy, or over it, or down the middle of it, or whatever, depending on its size, because occasionally it was necessary to sort of mix it with the ships if they weren't happy about something in the middle of the convoy, which we could see, but they couldn't. It was usually then, having perhaps spent 4 hours doing that, and in that time, of course, flying about 500 miles around, because some of these convoys looked to be filling half the Atlantic, because they, I think at that time, they tended to, if they had 4 warships available, even if they were only corvettes, they'd get as many ships as they could, because they packed them with stuff over in North America, and it took so long to get them into convoy shape, particularly where they had to come from different sources in North America, some from USA, some from Canada, and so on. There were these large convoys with very little, really, in the way of naval protection. So, having had a good look around and carried out, investigated any queries, we would then do a search ahead of the convoy as far as we could within the limits of range, endurance, petrol, and then report back to the SNO, then off we go back.
Would you ever patrol behind the convoy at all?
Oh yes, it would be part of the normal. We go all the way round in our first approach.
And at this time, I mean, you'd mentioned that you had the early radar when you were doing the patrols in the English Channel. Was that being used at the same time to try and spot any?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't really of any use to us. I'm not quite sure whether you mean in helping us find the convoy or in use when we actually had found it.
I was actually thinking of detecting U-boats, but of course, obviously, at this stage, as you say, it was more. I remember the English Channel. It was actually to detect large capital ships you were using it for, wasn't it? At the time.
Well, yes, so, yeah. But the U-boat didn't expose as much of itself above sea level, above the water level, as even the smallest of the tramp steamers, which would be in the convoy. No, the thing would be, you see, that because I queried whether we were interested in whether ASV would help us find the convoy, because that would be most unlikely. It may have happened once or twice, I can't really remember, but all that it could have done would have been to, assuming we were flying at 2,000 feet, would be to give the wireless operator, the ASV operator, same thing in most cases, he would be picking up a lot of, background, frazzle, fizzle, whatever they used to call it. Because not only if there was a U-boat, or let's forget about the U-boat, if we were hoping for help from the ASV to find the convoy, there would be so much that the ASV would be taking in, it wouldn't be able to deal with it because there were so many blobs or blurs, or can't think of the word again, commonplace then, but gone now. There would be so many blips, for him to deal with, which would be mixed with the frazzled, frizzled, or whatever they used to call it, of the sea echoes at a low altitude, that it was virtually, you couldn't be certain. You wouldn't say, well, I think my estimated position is better than the one that you're getting on your ASV, so I'm going to stick to that. Then if we didn't find it, then it could be some help, I suppose, because we wouldn't have missed the convoy by very much in terms of nautical miles. And looking at it from a different viewpoint in the sky may have given a different reaction on the ASV tube.
So am I right in thinking that the majority of your anti-submarine patrol, i.e. in locating the convoy or potentially finding threats, was all down to...
Navigation.
Navigation and the use of your eyes, was it, the crew's eye?
At that stage. I mean, when I look at the difference, you see, I missed operational flying in the later stages of the war, which I regret through no fault of my own, but because I wanted to go back on ops, but I didn't. Because it had changed so much. It was unbelievable that... for one thing, when I've talked to ex-colleagues at squadron get-togethers and so on, and 220 Squadron went, converted from Hudson's on to Flying Fortresses, not the usual Liberators, but... what they had to say was so different to what I had experienced myself. I couldn't, for one thing, reconcile myself to flying one of these great big, to me then, Liberators instead of a handy thing you could throw around the sky if you wanted to and do all kinds of things in it, and yet they had such with all the advances that they were carrying. I mean, I don't suppose we could get all the aerials that were on aircraft, the four engine stuff, at the end of the war. I couldn't get it on Hudson and so on, and so it was not fully satisfactory in 1941, and Churchill was quite right to say we're. But of course he was a better forecaster than Hitler, because at this time Hitler was saying that they were having great success with their U-boats, and he said in 6 weeks this war in the Atlantic will be over. So at least that didn't happen, and there must be some reason for it.
What kind of range would you do on these operations? How far out would you go into the Atlantic?
It depends. Let's look at it from the extreme range. About 600 miles would be the limit. Normally, they reckoned there was an arc of 600 miles from various, 500 miles from various airfields all down the Scottish west coast. Now, of course, places on the islands so on, and from the southwest. So we were covering about an area of 500 miles from land all the way down the Atlantic by the end of 1941. But of course not continuously, and this was one of the great failings that we just couldn't avoid, because we didn't have the equipment and the aircraft to do it. But 600 miles, although it has been known, of course, to do more, there was one particular instance where we were encouraged, having gone on a particular patrol, rather than an escort, patrol out into the Atlantic to a limit of 500 miles, and we were encouraged to extend the flight if we thought it safe to do so according to petrol reserves. On this occasion we did, and we happened to be taking the commanding officer of the squadron every so often. He wasn't a fully flying sort of chap, I mean in the sense that he wasn't always anxious to go, but obviously it was his duty to do so. And on this occasion it was a very, very bumpy day. And of course he didn't give up. He didn't expect any member of the crew to give up their seat, take over. So he was more or less standing in the astro bubble halfway down the fuselage most of the time. Keep an extra pair of eyes, always welcome. But as I say, it was very bumpy, and he was not able to walk in a straight line from A to B because of the movement of the aircraft. And so he was going to the back of the aircraft quite frequently, where the small toilet was, and the rear gunner was quite a vocal, dear me, cockney, a vocal cockney with a lovely turn of phrase, explaining what the commanding officer was doing at this little space just below the turret, the back of the aircraft. So that's the sort of thing that could happen if you extended the patrol, and it was always a case of well done if you did so.
If you were doing a convoy escort, though, what kind of average time would you have, or say an average convoy, what kind of average time would you be able to be over the convoy for?
Well, about 3 or 4 hours. That would be at maximum range.
Is that quite fatiguing, obviously, because you're spending a lot of time looking and over that period of time at the sea. Is that a factor?
Well, it's not. I don't think it's a factor in determining the length of time that you're doing it, that you can do it. It may be a factor. It's not one that's come to my notice. It's that kind of thing which you're not conscious of, really. You're doing a job, and breaks in your concentration, of course. Somebody else would keep an eye open whilst you went down to the back to use this little convenience, that sort of thing. Or you could fly during the period we were flying from Wick, and during 1941 there were two pilots. Don't forget, we still had the two pilots, one navigating, one piloting stage. Later on, of course, that was in a second tour, that wasn't the case. It was a pilot and a navigator. So to leave the controls, you would have to leave the aircraft on automatic pilot, but only for a short period of time. But we also had the pleasure of flasks of hot coffee or whatever, and sandwiches, of course, to break the monotony. If only you could break the monotony of the sandwiches, it was okay.
But the anti-submarine patrols, how were they organised? Would you be given an area to go over? Would you be allowed a certain amount of freedom within that choice? Or would you be just given a kind of free-ranging patrol over a section of the Atlantic?
No, you would have probably have a course, a track, which you work out your own course. a track that you were supposed to go out on, with probably a square search at the end of it, or crossover search, something of that kind, obviously observe the situation down below, but perhaps more than likely to go to a certain position where the Admiralty wanted more information about it. So they weren't just sort of we weren't our own masters in that sense. It's more a matter of how we accomplished the task, which had to be done as briefed.
I imagine fuel was an issue as well with such flights, that you'd have to keep a close eye on the fuel. Were there any occasions where that presented any problems?
Well, no problems, provided you were not trying to run the aircraft in a way different to that laid down by the designers. On the Hudson, there were four wing tanks, and a dial for two dials for each tank. One showed the amount, I don't know whether I'm right in using the word odometer, a display like mph of a car. There was that indicator, fuel tank level indicator, and a mechanical switch with four segments on it. I think I'm right, it's M4. Anyway, there were segments marked on it. Front, rear, for both wings, left front, left rear, right front, right rear. And the dial indicated the amount of tank for the amount of fuel for the tank selected on this selector. So as long as you knew how much fuel you had in a particular tank, it was perfectly straightforward. You knew when the time came to change onto a different tank. And there was a system of changing. I think it went from, in order to balance, keep the aircraft balanced, left front to right rear, right front to left rear, something like that. So it's just really a matter of keeping a check. But unfortunately, not every pilot did that. And we were on a patrol, I think we were on the way out actually to a convoy escort. Yes, we were. Yeah. My co-pilot, I was flying the machine that day, irrespective of whether we should be alternating or not, because he was relatively new on the squadron. And so I said, I'm going back to the to have a look out, stretch my legs, going to have a look out of the astro bubble. And he got in the pilot's position. And then after I'd been back a few minutes, I saw the nose begin to dip, looking down the cabin past the pilot. And then this angle of decline, we were then about 1,000 feet increased, and I could see that he was pushing the throttle levers forward and pulling them back again with some urgency. So I went forward and found that the engines were not giving much thrust, and they were in fact gradually slowing down. And he tried to explain what he'd done, the position we were in. So I turned back to the wireless shop and said, send out an SOS, plain language, and give them a position of where we are from the navigator. And then check, as I turned back, my eye just happened to see, I don't remember looking at it especially, that the selector was not on the tank which was being shown on the dial. And so the correction was obvious. I turned on another tank, and there's a handle in between, well, in the sticking out at the back of the throttle quadrant, which you pumped the hand pump for the petrol system. So of course we got onto a full tank and cranked the handle, and the engines picked up again. And by that time we were down to about a couple of hundred feet. So we then obviously pulled away, got back up to a reasonable height. But as it happened, this message was sent when we were at the lowest level. And when we were up at our, 1,500 feet or whatever, I said, you'd better send a signal to the wireless operator. You better send a signal to cancel the previous SOS. And by the time we were flying straight and level again, he had a reply to say, what SOS? And we discovered when we landed that they hadn't received this SOS, because we were below the height that was necessary at that particular point because of the intervention of the high land of Scotland from the radio station. The signal, I think it was picked up in Gibraltar or something like that. We had that sort of bouncing of signals quite a lot in the end, I think.
Was that just an experience of your co-pilot, really, at that stage? Had he just selected
the type of view? We all had a good laugh about it, but I think he remembered ever afterwards.
When something happens like that, Ted, obviously, how do you handle it as such? Do you make a joke of it afterwards, obviously, rather so because you understand that he's learned the lesson, or
it's necessary. I think you learn those lessons pretty quickly. It would be rubbed in, as it were, in the mess, because of course we were all sergeants, so we were in the same mess. Well, he wasn't actually. He was a flying pilot officer. But so far as he was concerned, it would come to him the reprimand. Well, it wasn't the reprimand, no. The fact that it had happened. He would be left in no doubt about it by the chief wireless officer, who would have handled the signals, or been reported to him anyway. So, yes, we can be sure that he... there's no need to make a fuss or a thing like that.